succession number 27083, reel 45.
And had been turned into a...
So, Sir Henry, you leave and join Albion in 1970.
Yes, March of 70, I joined her in Portsmouth, and a big ship with three separate but yet integrated elements on board. First, there was the ship's company, same as any other ship's company, but being a big ship, rather more of them. Then there was the main armament, so to speak, which was the embarked commando group, because she by then had been turned into a commando carrier, fixed-wing carrier, fixed-wing flying being out, except for the Old Ark Royal, which even then was the end of her tether. And the third element, of course, was the helicopter squadron, mainly Wessex 5s, troop lift Wessex, of which we had a full squadron, and a couple of Wasps and so forth, little ones for reconnaissance purposes. And each of these elements numbered, give or take, 800. So there were a lot of guys on board. We had all the cooks and the stewards in the wardroom. All the cooks, ship's company, and officers were Chinese, and we had a Chinese element within the previous figures of about a couple of hundred, and they were very interesting.
They came from Hong Kong.
They came from Hong Kong, yes, and they had their own drafting authority, as it were, in Hong Kong. Albion had been adopted, you understand what I mean, every ship is, or practically every ship, is adopted by some town in the country. She had been adopted by the Cinque Ports, and that's that clutch of ports which I won't enumerate on around the east coast of Kent. And the Cinque Ports met, to use the ancient historic term, they met in brotherhood and guestling from time to time. And this was a fairly rare occasion. And the previous occasion was, 15 years before. And it was back, I think, I'm not sure, it wasn't back in Churchill's time. I think it probably was. Either Churchill or Menzies, who was the Australian Prime Minister. I think he was Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports in his time.
Was he?
I think so. Anyway, it was an unusual occurrence. And this blew up 3 weeks after I took over the ship. And it was to take place at Hastings. That was the selected Cinque Port for this occasion. And it was a great performance, and we foregathered at the town hall or wherever early in the morning, about 9 o'clock, which meant we had to get there the night before. And we processed in full fig with all the local dignitaries, the mayors of all the towns and so forth, to a selected church where we had a rattling good church service. And we then repaired back to the town hall of the selected Cinque Port, in this case Hastings, where they had their meeting. And I, as a sort of guest, sat up on the top table, and which was littered with maces and this's and that's and so forth. It was very well attended, and there were huge bunches of flowers everywhere. The place was it was like Chelsea Flower Show, it really was. And we tottered through the agenda, which was pretty formal and pretty inconsequential, but all great fun. They were terribly nice about it. And then I was taken to one side while the others went off to some local hotel and started to tank up. And I was taken there rather later on with the mayor of Hastings, I suppose. And we had a very good lunch, which went on till about 4:30 in the afternoon, in the course of which I had to make a speech. And I was going to pick up a young lad who was a great friend of one of my children's godparents, and he'd just broken his ankle, and he was covered in plaster and that sort of thing. And he quite clearly, it was in the summer, or beginning of summer, it was quite a hot day, and he quite clearly hadn't been near a bath since he'd broken his ankle. And he absolutely hummed. And he was on crutches, of course. And just as I was wondering how on earth I could include him in the mayor's tea party, and Mary had come up to meet me and take him home and so forth. And you could see a sort of aura around this very nice lad indeed. But nevertheless, the mayor was not the least bit perturbed at this. We had a jolly good fun fight, and that was that. We then got running, and I quickly came to terms with the team I had on board, and a very good team it was. I had excellent sergeants. These were departmental heads at commander's level. And the only one at that level who was a bit of an oddball was curiously the chaplain, who was no good at all, and I eventually had to sack him. So there it was.
When you sack a man like that, what do you do?
Put him ashore and let somebody else sort it out. And I did, and I'd warned the chaplain of the fleet, who I have to say, without mentioning his name, was as wet as a scrubber at the time. And I warned him that I thought it was very unlikely this bloke would stay the course. And 2-3 months later, he committed yet another serious indiscretion. And I reckoned enough was enough. So I put him ashore with a strong recommendation that he should not be employed, certainly at sea again, and really wasn't wanted in the Navy anymore. And the CNC ashore at Northwood backed me on this, and he was appointed to the boys' training establishment at Shotley. And anyone less suitable would have been hard to imagine. And that was that. We didn't have a very good chaplain of the fleet at the time. It was my very early days of trying to fly a helicopter. And I'd been bitten by the bug when I was commanding Galatea, because we had our own Wasp. But it did not have a dual kit. And so, although I used to go up from time to time, I couldn't actually fly it. I had done a short flying course at Osprey outside Portland. And really, I'd only done enough to convince me beyond any doubt at all that there was a great deal more to it than I had ever conceived before, and that I really wasn't up to it at all. And I remember going up with a dual kit, and once we got to a safe height, my tormenting pilot said, right, sir, now I'll hand over control to you. And I said, fine. There was no auto-stabilization, and he handed over control, and nothing happened. We just flew on perfectly peacefully. And then he said, well, that's fine, sir. You seem to have got that all right. Now let's just try a gentle turn to starboard. And so I moved the stick a bit, and I instantly upset the state of equilibrium, and we were all over the sky. And then I knew that there was a good deal more to it. However, I was determined, and you know, this, with my Royal Marines commander, this was my main armament. And I made it quite clear that I was going to fly with every pilot in the squadron, whether they liked it or not, and so on. And with this in view, before we embarked the squadron, which they'd been disembarked down at Caldreres, I mugged up the names of all the pilots. And the commander in flying control, just above the bridge, he had a large board of the prison staff, as it were. And I demanded a copy of this, and he didn't like it. He was rather a stuffy officer, and he thought I was encroaching on his preserves. And I said, now, come on. I'm trying to get to know your people. And because I shall see them so seldom, this is the only way I can get to know their names. Give. And he didn't. I finally more or less had to give him an order. Anyway, I got the photographs, and I mugged them up. And the day came when they flew on board, and once they'd all stowed their machines below and so forth, they lined up in flying control just above the bridge, and I went down the line to meet each one of them, and so forth. And I had learned their surname, their Christian name, and their principal job, because they had certain specific jobs within the squadron. And there was one whose face I couldn't place, and he was about two-thirds of the way down the line. I haven't forgotten it. And I went down and I said, sometimes they started to say their name, and if they didn't, I said their name, and hoped to score a couple of merit points thereby, and so forth. And this worked out very well indeed. Gradually getting closer to this totally unfamiliar face. And eventually I came to him, and I stood opposite to him, and I was very cross because I really had done my prep, and he was going to let me down. And I stood opposite him, and I said, who the bloody hell are you? And he said, so-and-so, sir. And I said, my God, you shaved your bloody beard off. And he had. We became great friends afterwards.
Can I just ask you, you wanted to meet and fly with all the pilots on board. What other steps did you take, apart from what you've just described, to, if you like, impose your style on Albion and to let them know what you wanted? You've got a large ship's company, and it's a large ship generally. How do you, as captain, what did you do in your first weeks in order to...
You moved around the ship. You came across lots of people working at lots of things and so forth. You picked up too much information by doing that. You got satiated with different faces, different names, and so forth. But some of it stuck. And you went on doing this. For instance, I had And I will remember, to my shame, I used to have breakfast at a time, about 7:30 or so, and always be up on the flight deck in harbour for colours at 8 o'clock. And I'd never served in a carrier before. And it was quite a torturous way round to get up to the flight deck. Once you've got it, of course, it was dead easy, but I hadn't got it, and I was busy meeting my head's at apartments and all the rest of it, and so on. And I got lost, and I ended up in a Chinese mess deck, in a Chinese bathroom, and they were in a hoots about this, because they weren't normally expecting to be entered by their captain at 5 to 8 in the morning. And so on, that sort of thing. The pilots, of course, you've got to know by flying with them, and there's no quicker way of coming to terms with another human being, in my experience, regardless of the difference in rank, because he's the boss, he's the expert, he knows what he's doing. I didn't, but nevertheless, you're trying to do it and determined, and they respected that, I think. I'll come on to one or two incidents in a moment.
Okay.
I frightened most of them, but I frightened myself too, and that was quite good for the soul. And the Royal Marines commanders were interesting. I had two during my time. One was 40 and the other was 45. And they're still going, I think. And in differing ways, they were quite different. I think I've got this the right way around. Without saying which was which, one had a not frightfully impressive, perfectly nice, but not frightfully impressive commanding officer. Not terribly impressive officers as a whole. Excellent NCOs and a pretty good team of Marines. The other had an excellent commanding officer, very good crowd of officers, rather indifferent NCOs, and par for the course Marines. They were quite different. And into the bargain, as often as not, we had what did we have? We had a I think we had a company, yes, of Dutch Marines, Royal Netherlands Marines. The two navies were pretty close, and they thought very much the same, and so forth. And the Dutch Marines, the officers all spoke good English. The Marines did not. And on the main drag from my quarters aft up to the bridge, it was a long haul, a long straight passage. And very often you'd pass in the middle of the night or whenever, you'd pass some of these Dutchmen just sort of hanging around waiting for the canteen to open or to get another cup of cocoa or something. And instead of sort of stumping stuffily through and not saying anything, or just giving a grin but not saying anything, I thought one had to do better than that. And I used to say good morning, and I don't speak Dutch, but I think good morning in Dutch is very much the same as good morning in English. And it might be in the middle of the night, but I would grin at them and say good morning. And they all knew I was trying to communicate, and they responded, broad grins, and they'd all say good morning back. And so it worked a treat. One of the earlier incidents was, and this was in, I suppose, May 1970, that we had to go round the corner and up the Irish Sea to Liverpool for the annual Battle of the Atlantic commemoration. And this was an annual event, and the senior officer dominating it was the Commander-in-Chief, Plymouth. He flew up and was then going to use us as his flagship for the various ceremonies there. And the ceremonies lasted across a weekend, and we got up, I suppose, on the Friday, and we probably sailed on the Monday or so. And there were receptions, and we beat retreat on the Saturday. And then there was the mammoth service in Liverpool Cathedral on the Sunday, on the Sabbath. And shortly before we were due to sail for this, there was a tug strike. And I thought, oh, well, and I'd handled the ship a bit, but not all that much by then. And there's something about handling a carrier that is rather different from handling a destroyer.
Can you? I
or a frigate.
About to ask. Can you just enlighten me on the difference?
Well, to begin with, you've got a lot of power there, but you've got a hell of a lot of windage too. You've got a lot of ship sticking up above the surface of the sea, and it catches the wind like mad. And if you get out of control, it's it can be quite tricky. They're relatively easy to handle, but you have the unfamiliar situation that, whereas in any other ship than a carrier, you can stand by the main compass, the Pelorus, on the bridge, and you are exactly in the centre line. And therefore you know precisely, within very fine limits, where your bow is pointing, and your bow is clearly defined as the bar, because you can see it all. With a carrier, the bridge, of course, is to one side. Mm-hmm. It's to the starboard side. And so you have to accustom yourself to looking not at the bar, which is not well defined because it's a great broad sweep, but at a little sort of pin mast that is directly ahead from the position of your Pelorus, which is itself right out to the starboard side of the ship. And I used to tax myself with this and think, this is going to be sheer hell, and it's going to take all the fun out of ship handling. And so, and the other thing is, of course, that you tend to be hauled around by tugs when you're berthing and unberthing because of the nature of things. And I quickly found you rapidly became acclimatized to this off-centering, and it didn't really present a problem. But now I was presented with the other problem, that there was a tug strike. So up we went to Liverpool, and we arrived off the tail of the bank at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was not foggy, but it was visibility was poor, and it was misty. And it was blowing quite hard, and it was unpleasant. And the whole area was milling with ships, waiting for a pilot to go up and into the port. As were we. Some ships had anchored, some ships hadn't. It was pretty chaotic. And it wasn't much fun. And eventually, our pilot arrived. And he was drunk. Quite clearly drunk. And he came up to the bridge. And I had, I think by then, established sufficient rapport with my navigating officer, who was a splendid man called Reynolds, Lee Reynolds, and a very good navigator too. And we looked at each other, and sort of whispered, so that this chap wouldn't overhear, that we'd better watch him like a hawk, because he didn't seem to be very reliable. And the plan was that he took us right up into an inner basin where we anchored for what was left of the night, and then at something like 8 o'clock in the morning, that morning, we would weigh anchor and under our own steam go alongside Prince's Pen, the other side of the basin. And the tide there is considerable, to say the least. And I knew that from javelin days. The range is very, very great. And to get alongside, it had to be slack water. And we had about half an hour in which to do it. Well, the pilot did not contribute very materially in getting us into the basin. But that was all right. And we got there. And we anchored. And when it came later that morning to weigh anchor and go alongside, they had provided an ocean-going tug, which was Navy manned, as opposed to, and therefore not subject to the strike, but equally totally unsuitable for pushing a carrier with her overhang around under these conditions to get alongside. And we got to a position that I was rather proud of. We were about 10, might have been 20, don't think it was, feet off the jetty and paralleled up. And we got stuck. And it didn't matter what you did with the head rip and what you did with the stern rip, but you couldn't haul the ship in. And the tug tried, and it snapped its mast off, because it had misjudged the overhang. And we were there for a couple of hours or so, and so forth. So that was an interesting situation. Then we got through all that, and I won't go on about Liverpool. When we left, we had the same pilot, and we were leaving at something like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the simple thing to do was to ask this chap on board for lunch. And I was actually quite glad to do so, because I briefed my Chinese petty officer steward that when he arrived on board, I would offer him a drink. And he would almost say, certainly say, that he would like a glass of gin. And I said, you give him a glass of gin, a normal glass of gin. And if I offer him another drink, he will probably say he'd like another gin. And you are to give him water only, but don't say anything about it. And so it happened. It was predictable, really. And he had his glass of gin, and I didn't, because I was just going to see him. And he readily accepted another one, and he's given a glass of water. And he didn't complain. Whether he twigged, I don't know to this day. And so we got out of Liverpool, and that was all right. But it was a bit indicative. We had trouble with pilots in that trip. I have more to come later on. And then we got back to, I suppose we got back to Portsmouth. But I remember there was one occasion, it was a lovely evening, and there was nothing going on, there was nobody else in company. We were underway at sea. And I was up on the flight deck, taking a breath of fresh air with my executive officer. And suddenly up from below came the Chinese. And they seemed to be in a pretty ugly mood. And they came scrabbling up onto the flight deck. And They were jabbering away, and they were shaking their fists, and they were scowling at each other and chattering like monkeys. And I thought they were going to indulge in a free fight. As I say, there were a couple of hundred of them. And I was beginning to get a spot anxious about this, and wondering whether it wasn't time for me to delegate to my executive officer and retire below to the safety of my cabin, because it really looked pretty ugly, when suddenly two of them detached from the main throng and raced up the flight deck to the bow and raced back again. And then all was different, and they stopped shouting and they stopped screaming, and they all had broad grins on, and they scuttled away below. They'd had a bet. They were a remarkable team. But it looked very ugly at the time. We went on a visit to Wilhelmshaven. This was just a goodwill, routine, operational visit. We had to have a pilot, and we took him on board, and there was a sort of outer basin, and we were going to berth in the big lock, which went on further up. And the pilot came on board. He wasn't drunk or anything. He was a huge man, and he had only limited English, and he wasn't really very expert in his English.